All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veteran disability law firm, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800. Here on Veterans Radio today, we are pleased to have with us Father Conrad Targonsky, known to most folks as Father Conrad. Father Conrad, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you very much for inviting me, Jim. Good to be here.
We're glad to have you. Father Conrad is a retired Navy captain, and so we wanted to get him on to talk a little bit about his service and what it's like, the duties of chaplains in today's service. Father Conrad, talk to us a little bit about your upbringing and background.
Okay, I'm from Chicago, Illinois, home of the World Series Cubs. Very proud to say that.
And you've been waiting a long time to say that.
I was standing right here. But no, I was born in Chicago, and I was very much influenced by my family, who we had priests and nuns and whole Catholic tradition. I'm from a Polish tradition, actually. And I went to high school in Wisconsin, and then from there I joined the Franciscan Order back in 1966. I went to the University of Wisconsin for undergraduate, the Aquinas Institute of Theology, when it was in Dubuque, Iowa, and then it was ordained in 1975. But I should really add there that the influence of the military has always been in the back of my mind. I've been trying to figure this out recently. My mother's two brothers were World War II veterans. And then when I went to the high school conducted by the Franciscans, we had an English teacher who was a former Army and a Korean War veteran. And I'll never forget, he wore his Franciscan habit, but he didn't wear sandals. He all wore his polished boots. And it intrigued me. And I think it probably stuck in my mind. So when I joined the Franciscan Order, our drill instructor, we don't call him that, though, we call him a Master of Novices, had just retired from the Army. So there you go, you know, influence upon influence. And then, of course, through I was ordained a priest, I spent some time in Mississippi and at a university down there, inner city Milwaukee. And then from there, I should add, my whole background is I'm a runner. And even at my age, in my late 60s, I still run at least a 5K every day. I'm a fanatic. But at that particular time when I was in Milwaukee, I was getting ready for the Milwaukee Marathon, and I had run from the north side to the south side and passed through what they call Jones Island. And the Navy Marine Corps Reserve Center, and I stopped in to get a drink of water, and I came out sworn in a sailor. So got to be careful with those places. But I always was intrigued by what the chaplains did, and my first assignment was actually besides Fort McCoy, I spent some time in drilling. I was for a brief time a reservist. I went straight to Okinawa to the Marine Corps station out there, and I learned very quickly, and chaplains have training schools as well, and ours was in Newport, Rhode Island, and I was surprised to find out that in my particular instance that we joined the Navy, but we also served the Marine Corps, the Coast Guard, and there were two Navy chaplains actually the Merchant Marine. So because I was a runner and I was very much in the physical fitness, they looked at me and said, Targonsky, Marine Corps. So there I was. But the chaplain has a long history. I just had the honor of addressing
Before we get into that, let me back you up, because you didn't tell us what year you entered the Navy.
1987.
You recently retired, didn't you?
I retired in 2010. It was like 22 years, I tell people, and some change. And so all those years, I was basically a very active chaplain, and you could get involved with administration and all that, but I was what they call a grunt. I liked being out in the field, I liked getting dirty, And I just had a philosophy: wherever the Marines went, I went. And when I went to Okinawa, or I should go back to actually Newport, Rhode Island, where we had our training, we found out that the chaplains, military chaplains, date back, well, I would say back to the 4th century, way before the United States, to a man by the name of Martin of Tours. And the story is very famous. He was a military person. He had was riding on his horse one day. He saw a man begging, and he had compassion on the man, didn't have any money with him, so he took off his cloak, and he cut it in half and gave half to that beggar. And later on, it says in the legend that Christ appeared to him and said that Martin had clothed me out of charity. But the story goes on by saying, whatever happened to Martin's half of the cloak? And they call that part of capella in Spanish, I believe. And military people continue to take that cloak into battle for blessing and protection. And the word for chaplain, I believe in Spanish, is capellán, which is and has been since earlier times a sign of protection and blessing. So the chaplain corps, basically United States Navy, basically is designed to provide religious services, but we care for everybody, we provide for our own, and we facilitate for others. And I always remember that because all religions, all faiths, especially the non-religious preference people, that we were their chaplain as well as for the confidentiality, for counseling, and for availability. So basically my career kind of involved with that story of Martin of Tours, and I had the honor of serving on my retirement in all four Marine divisions and ship and shore Navy. I think I pretty much did it all, including time in Iraq, which I can talk about a little bit later. I was stationed in a place called 29 Palms, California, and it's Mojave, Colorado Desert, a training area for combat. And we had received the warning order to begin what they call Operation Iraqi Freedom, and that was in the very first wave. And then during my 13 months there, I was a supervisory chaplain during a battle called Operation Phantom Fury in Fallujah. So basically, I was in Iraq where our unit was there at least 13 months. And then, of course, everything seems to flow from that time in Iraq, actually, in preparation. But the chaplain mode was very important because that's where you realize in a very, very real way and all the reason why we trained, why we are there. And again, those stories are deeply embedded in my mind and my heart.
So let me ask you, Father Conrad Targonsky, when you first got involved with the Navy and you signed up, it wasn't because of any family background. It was all these influences of other men that you had run into in your formative years. Did you see this as, hey, I'm in it for the long haul, or this is going to be, it's 1987, this is going to be sort of a short experiment and I'll go on to other things? What were you thinking, and how did that process evolve over time about, hey, I'm in this for the guys for the long haul?
Yeah, I think I approached it with let's try it and see. But you see, why I liked it so much was that I was very athletic, and I continued to I was what they call a gym rat, and I loved to run. And I thought to myself, you know what, this is probably the perfect ministry for me, because I was in a Catholic parish before, but I wasn't really happy. I'm a very active person right now. I'm at a university in western Wisconsin, and you know, it's very active. It's constant motivation, and I'm always around something new and exciting. And there was something about the chaplain corps that was almost made for me. So
did you think at that time? And I understand you were called Father Ski by many of the Marines.
Most of the time, Father Ski or Chaplain Ski or Padre, yeah.
So as how did this change for you as you as a chaplain began to be involved in action that hey, this wasn't just safe drilling somewhere or being in Okinawa. We're now gearing up for the fight. How did your perspective on the role of the chaplain in the division change over time?
Well, you know, I had some amazing mentors. And the chaplain corps is made up of all faith backgrounds. Well, you know, you're in a city and you have different churches, and occasionally the ministers, the priests, the imams or rabbis may meet and have what they used to call like teacup ecumenism and all that. But when I was in the Navy, the women and men I served with, and they're out there, were absolutely awesome. That we provided and cared for each other. And I think it came to a phenomenal head in war when we took care of each other. I was a supervisory chaplain in my particular area of operation. We were 15 chaplains. I was the only priest. So I had 14 chaplains, Protestant, different denominations and so forth. My whole perspective was to take care of them. And I think even now, we may not communicate, but, you know, we know who we are and what we did for each other and how we depended on each other because, you know, as Pope Francis would say, he would say, I want you to smell like the sheep. Well, it was no problem for us. You know, we were right in there. But we wanted to make sure we took care of each other. And the respect that we had for each other, for example, you know, when I was in Iraq, I keep on referring to that experience. That was the quintessence of what it meant to serve. I had these mount-out boxes, these cases, and I had my Bibles in there, but I had King James Version. I had the NIV Version. I have the Quran. I had the Tanakh. I had the Pearl of Great Price and the Book of Mormon. And I even had for Passover in Iraq, I had, you know what MREs are. There are meal packets.
Sure.
And I had special MREs for Passover. So when a Jewish Marine approached me and said, oh, Father, we're here in Iraq, and I know you have your services, but do you have anything here for us? I says, you'll never believe it. I actually have Passover. There were more than MREs. They had the fixings for Passover. Then he came to me the next day. He said, well, we need matzo for the next 8 days. And I said, you know what? You'll never believe it. I have also matzo with me. And his grandfather wrote me a letter and expresses sincere appreciation how we took care of each other. But that was common among the chaplains. And I think that was the influence that made me stay in for the long haul. And I think when I got to the present rank of which I retired, it was due to the influence and the guidance of so many chaplains out there that I'll never forget.
So for our non-Navy friends, listeners, Captain Targansky retired as a full bird so that the rest of you can translate it to your service, which is, you know, that's a pretty exalted rank. I'm curious as to your experiences, because the chaplains are administering to anybody who has a question of faith, needs counseling. Did you see all different types of denominations in your time in Iraq?
Oh, most definitely. But I'd like to say that the chaplains minister to everybody, even if they had no faith association at all. And the denominations were means of for myself to learn. And even when a Marine or a sailor would say, I'm not really a believer, but can I talk with you? And I says, of course. But that's where the chaplains always came in. And with the Marine Corps especially, it always seems that what was very kind of noteworthy about the Marine Corps was that we had the doctors and we had the nurses and the dentists, but we also had the corpsmen and the Navy corpsmen and the chaplains. And again, if there was a hike, if there was any type of activity, that's where you got to meet the sailors and the Marines. when they were out in the rain, when they were out in the field. And sometimes we had our own vehicles as chaplains, but you know, I'll tell you what, I preferred riding in the 7 tons and the 5 tons. That's where you met everybody. And that's where people who would normally not come and talk to you because maybe they would say they had no belief and all that. But one time we did have a vehicle. We had to do our preventive maintenance on a Monday, and I told my RP, and the RP is the chaplain assistant in the Navy. I said, let me go down and help you with the PM. He said, well, sir, you know, you don't have to go down. I can do it. No, I said, I want to learn. And those of you who are out there are probably know about anything about Humvees. Well, to tell you, I didn't know anything about Humvees, and I was looking all over the hood for the battery. And if you know where the battery is kept, it's kept under the A driver seat and so forth. But as I was down to it, a pair of dungarees in my RP and trying to figure out how we do this preventive maintenance, little by little, the Marines started to crowd around us and start giving us pointers and so forth. I thought to myself, this is what it's all about. And this is where you meet the people of all backgrounds. And here they are. They were actually teaching me. So you can tell my voice, I'm very excited about the ministry. It was, and I guess what chaplains have always talked about, Army chaplains, the Air Force chaplains, you know, the Guard chaplains and Coast Guard. Well, it's all about servant leadership. And when you talk about servant leadership, it's, yes, you have the rank, but we had two devices on our collar. We had the rank on the right, and we had our cross or our Star of David or Half Moon on the left. And I always told the chaplains, you put your religious device on first to remember why you're here. And I think that seems to be, you know, the essence of the chaplains in the military.
So Chaplain, I know that there's sort of I'll call it a shortage or a disproportionate number or lack of number of Muslim soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines.
Mm-hmm.
Does that also filter into I'll call it a shortage or a lack of imams or those of the Muslim faith in the chaplain corps?
Well, if there is a certain denomination or faith background that lacks a chaplain of their denomination, they have what they call lay leaders. This is also very, very, very true of Catholic priests. Right now, it's beyond critical. And the shortage of Catholic priests, you know, in the military. But there are lay leaders, and they are either people of that faith background that are trained by their particular, you know, representative to do what they can. So, for example, we had Muslim lay leaders. We had Latter-day Saint LDS lay leaders. And we've had many, many Catholic lay leaders. What can they do? Well, they can bring people together. They can read the Sunday scriptures and do whatever the archdiocese more or less maintains what we can do. But that seems to be, if there is a shortage, and that's how we try. I mean, yes, we like chaplains, and there would be a better way, but the lay leaders seems to be answering that need somewhat.
Did when you got called up and were sent off to Iraq and the Battle of Fallujah, did your Catholic priest colleagues back in the States find this highly unusual, scary, supportive? I'm kind of trying to understand what the response was from your community.
How could I answer that? I, you know, we were so far away. They knew I was going out. Many people were aware. There's an organization in the Catholic Church anyway. There are many other organizations that help different denominations. But the Knights of Columbus were awesome because some friends of mine, yeah, gave the Knights of Columbus my name, and they just send out the call, and all these boxes started coming into the area of operation, which was for everybody, by the way. And the priests, I would say it was very supportive, but again, those of us who have been there, it's very difficult to express what happened there to our families and to our acquaintances. And that's why I think when people come and tell a service person, you know, thank you for your service, someone said maybe they should say, thank you for your service, but how are you doing? Is there anything I can do to help? To make it sound that even though we don't understand, we try to listen. And I've been finding that more and more now as I work with combat vets and talk about our experiences. How do we communicate what has happened? And it's not just telling our story because it hurts sometime when you tell the story. So to answer your question, yes, people knew I was there, but nobody knew what we were experiencing. And I think you saw part of it on TV from what I understand.
Sure, yeah. And one of the experiences that you had was the Marines fighting in a very tough battle in the Battle of Fallujah. Can you maybe explain to our listeners, Chaplain, sort of what additional demands or stresses you had to experience and your chaplain group had to experience as a result of that particular battle?
It's difficult to talk about. However, I would say this. I personally haven't seen such valor. And when I was there, I told somebody this the other day, it almost seems surreal. You know, I have a group of vets that meet for, we met yesterday, and we meet for chicken wings, and just some camaraderie, and all different services, all different denominations, if they have any at all, and we come just kind of like this, you know, we talk, and we were talking about this, and how do you explain this to anyone except that when you're there, in a way, you know, I can say for being a priest, I was ordained for this, and it's a matter of just being there with my Marines and my sailors. And being a very shortage of priests there at that time, the Army would come and they would pick me up for Mass on Sunday, and I had to be traveling around, but I was telling people that, you know, I knew where we were going. We had the warning order that we were leaving, but I never knew what a tracer was until they were over my head. And I think when you come back and you start reliving some of the memories and so forth, you start realizing where you've been. And yet it becomes, I'll say this, it becomes very, very solemn, almost that you don't want to talk about specifics because what I saw there was almost unexplainable, that it was such valor. It's valor, and of course, in that particular battle, it was as horrific as the fighting was. Gee whiz, I don't know where to go from there. I'm sure the few listeners out there who have been in conflict similar or in that conflict particularly know what I'm talking about.
Well, I think what we're hopefully communicating to our listeners, Chaplain, is that there are men, women with the troops trying to counsel, trying to comfort, trying to deal with the horrific things they have to see and participate in. And I'm sure that your Marines were, their load was lightened a little by the fact that they had Father Ski with them. I'll end this interview before we get any more choked up on it by thanking Father Konrad Targonsky for participating today. He's as I said earlier, he's a Navy chaplain, retired after 22 years and some change as a captain. I want to thank our listeners to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com.
all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We're recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We are really honored today to have on Veterans Radio Dr. Chrissy-Anne Gordon, who has an interesting story of involvement with veterans and TBI. Dr. Gordon, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity. Thanks a lot.
Well, you have an interesting background that I'll let our listeners know a little bit about. You are a Youngstown, Ohio gal. You grew up in Youngstown and actually know my wife, Brigadier General Carol Ann Fossone. You guys went to Cardinal Mooney High School together.
Right.
You went on to Duquesne University and then ultimately the Ohio State University Medical School, where you graduated with your doctorate, summa cum laude. So you're one of the smarty pants from that group. And
I just the time, that's all.
Yeah. Well, there's always a lot of studying involved. So you have experience in internal medicine, emergency room medicine, occupational medicine, rehabilitative medicine, and you're board certified by the American Board of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation.
Correct.
So you've been a busy MD all these years.
I really enjoy it. I'm very blessed to have a job that I love every single day. So that's really good.
And what brings you to our program is that in about, I think it was 2008 or so, maybe a little in front of that, a friend of yours lost her son.
Correct.
He was in the Army. Tell us a little bit about that.
Correct. And it's very interesting, Jim, that we would be speaking today, because Sergeant Zachary McBride, just would have celebrated his 29th birthday on Sunday, this past Sunday, the 16th. His story is a Baptist minister's son from rural Oregon, Rhodes Scholar, had numerous scholarship opportunities available, but remembers being in middle school when the towers came down and made his decision along with some of his schoolmates that day that they were going to join the great service of our nation, join military service, and do some things to right some wrongs. So I'm very much attached to him and his story. He was only in Iraq 4 months when he went into a booby-trapped house with about five other members of his party, and all of these young men lost their lives in that occasion. So he was just turned 20. His parents, as many military members know, I'm not from a military family, and I thank you and your wife, Brigadier General Carol Ann, for helping me with this part, but they had to actually sign for him to go in early because he was only 17 when he graduated from high school. So with the fact that he died and his parents' guilt and the survival guilt from the members of his comrades around him, I decided to do something else to remember him, and that was to volunteer my services at the Chalmers P. Wiley, the outpatient clinic for the VA here in Columbus, Ohio. This was his, he was killed in action on January 9th, 2008, and I began my tour of duty, my service with them. I contacted them right after his funeral on January 19th and volunteered my services to do the traumatic brain injury screening. So that's how I got started down that pathway.
Well, on behalf of all veterans, I want to thank you for mobilizing your skills and services to help veterans. And I do think in a country where such a small percentage of people now serve, this isn't during Vietnam with the draft or even World War One or Two where everybody was involved. We now live in a volunteer force period, and there's a lot of disconnect for people to understand what goes on in the service. So you jumping right in and saying, I've got to do something, I've got to do my part,
right,
is really commendable, and hopefully things others will do. But where did that experience lead you to?
Well, I will say it's very interesting. I was smiling when you were giving, you know, all of my schooling, because, you know, that part is important. But I tell my young heroes coming back that what qualifies me most for this position to assist them when any way possible is that I've been lucky enough to be a victim of a traumatic brain injury myself. And by that I'm saying it was really a clumsy move on my part, putting up Christmas decorations about 15 years ago. And as I can relate to the young heroes coming back, I certainly did not have my brain injury by seeing my brothers and sisters in front of me blown up in an IED, an improvised explosive device explosion. But I had many of the same characteristics, kind of the hypervigilance, avoiding crowds, all of the above. So the first individual, the first young man that I interviewed at the VA, it was really a defining moment in my life, because we went through all of these screens and I said, well, you know, you definitely have a traumatic brain injury, but according to these screens, you have post-traumatic stress disorder, which means that I do too. And I was putting up, you know, Christmas decorations, so how could this be? And I will tell you that the young man grabbed my wrist so tightly, and he looked me right in the eye and said, so, Doc, what you're telling me is I'm not crazy. That was a wake-up call for me. You know, that was patient number one. And I sat there, you know, at that point in time, I've got to tell you, I was thinking that I would be there for a couple months. I volunteered several days a month. I'd be there for a couple months and move on. And I looked and I go, oh, my golly. You know, if these young people coming out of here, and he was 21 years old, you know, I mean, there's a lot of life in front of him for him to think that he has a mental disease. As I tell him that TBI and even PTSD, we're proving now, are actually forms of brain injury. So I tell all of these young folks, you're out of your brains, not out of your minds. And that's how physicians and healthcare providers need to look at it. And as you and Carolyn know, there's not a whole huge segment in the healthcare profession in general that understands traumatic brain injury. There's only about 8 to 10% of us in the country that actually, you know, take care of this particular injury. So,
well, and let me back up. Your prior medical training and experience wasn't with this injury, or wasn't with psychiatry or some other, you know, a brain specialty, was it?
Well, you know, we in rehab medicine, physical medicine and rehabilitation actually has a subset in traumatic brain injury, and we like to think of ourselves as being the ones who really know what to do about it, because we are very holistic. You know, we are not neurologists, who I just adore, but they look primarily at the brain and spinal cord. And in rehab medicine, you look at everything, the social, you know, what is this person going to do, not just tomorrow, but next week and a month after that and a year after that. So, yes, physical medicine, we aren't a huge specialty. There's about 4,500 to 5,000 of us specialized here in throughout the nation. So certainly it became a defining moment for me, thinking, you know, we need to mobilize all of the PM&R people, and there's not very many of them in the VA. The Veterans Administration, and you coined it right there, has notoriously used psychologists and psychiatrists to treat what was then known in the Vietnam era as post-traumatic stress disorder. And where that's really very helpful, the new, you know, kind of imaging surfaces that we have available to, you know, detect brain pathology is telling us now, you know, this is a little different type of process going on in the brain than we had originally thought. So it's a great learning time, and I think that so many of our young veterans have been willing to, you know, kind of been studied at various institutions to prove what exactly is going on in their brains.
And I think, well, I'm jumping out of order in my own mind here, but
okay.
Can you talk a little bit more about how the imaging technology has given medicine a whole new look at this problem? And I mean new as in, this is like in the last, what, 5 years or something that this has begun to evolve?
Correct. You know, again, I say my best training was my own brain injury, where after I kind of hit my head against the wall, literally, I was unconscious for somewhere around 20 minutes or so. I'm not quite quite sure. But when I kind of came to, I was unable to speak, and I was unable to speak for over 6 weeks and had no feeling in the right side of my body. And yet, when I was taken to the emergency room about 6 hours later, I had a totally normal MRI. And even though I wasn't thinking very clearly at that time, I sat there and said, you know, I'm sitting there thinking, I'm not making this up. You know, I can't speak. I know what I want to say, and none of the words will formulate. So I became very interested way back when, about 12 years ago, that, you know, there must be more here than even the MRI, which was the gold standard at that time. Well, since that time, we've even taken brain imaging a couple steps further, and one of my favorite tools is the diffusion tensor MRI, which is using a lot stronger magnet than is normally used in an MRI, and it shows not just large areas of compromise, but can actually get down almost to the cellular level, to the, you know, there is the nerve cell or a cluster of nerve cells, and here are their axons, here are their feelers going out to the brain cells telling what to do, and you can actually see where those have been ripped and where they are bleeding on an almost individual level, and that's what is needed to diagnose the traumatic brain injury of the IED explosion or the mortar explosions or what was ultimately going on in the brains of the Vietnam veterans back in the 60s and 70s, but we had no ability to see it.
So that's what the new technology really kind of allows, is you can actually see the that it's a physical injury in the brain.
Correct.
And I don't think everybody in the general population understands that or looks at it that way. I think we're probably still a decade or two behind catching up.
Right.
But from a medical standpoint, you now have – you have information you didn't have before.
Right, exactly. So, you know, I have to thank, you know, you and Brigadier General and the Brain Injury Association of Michigan, because for your listeners in that area, you are actually very helpful for our foundation early on, Resurrecting Lives Foundation early on, in getting about 25 young veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan who had had a blast injury. Something had blown up right near them, and their age matched sibling who had not had any brain injuries, and we took them to Albert Einstein University in the Bronx, where the number one diffusion tensor imager in the nation, Dr. Michael Lipton, was willing to bring his entire team, and literally, you know, they donated great hours of time to this project to prove to both the Department of Defense and the VA that there was an actual injury. And they were able to do that. It was an amazing thing. We had the great folks from the state of Michigan and the Brain Injury Association and Major Richard Briggs for helping us out with that. So thank you for helping us get going.
Well, I think it's really important work, and it goes back to your patient number one who said, you mean I'm not crazy?
Yes.
You can now tie it back to, yeah, this isn't a mental disease.
Correct.
This is a physical, organic injury inside the brain.
Correct. And to add just one other thing, so we have those special testing going on at Albert Einstein and at St. Louis University, Washington University in St. Louis, a Dr. David Brody was using a little different variation of the MRI, and that was kind of looking at what we call functional MRI, and it kind of tells you what part of the brain is working at what time. And he was able to determine that post-traumatic stress disorder not only is much more prominent in people with brain diseases, but actually is a form of a brain injury. It is kind of a chemical replay of the situation that was very dire to you. You know, as I tell my young heroes, it's a survival mechanism that's kind of gotten a little bit on auto drive. You know, you can't quite turn it off like you'd like to, but what the brain does is keep remembering the last thing that led to your survival when perhaps those around you did not survive. And it plays it over a few too many times. But since we now know that that's kind of a chemical brain injury and the blast injury kind of causes something within the brain cells itself, we can begin to treat this in just a little different way, which is cognitive rehab and using rehabilitation techniques rather than some of the psychotropic medications used in the past that kind of, you know, slow the brain down or kind of snow it. So it's a totally different, you know, it was a totally different thing for the VA and the DOD to embrace. And I am amazed at how quickly they have made that turnaround. And in no small part due to programs like this and getting the civilian world, the 99% of the resources involved in the reintegration and rehabilitation of our returning veterans.
Well, one of the things, and I think you've hit on it, and that is you've got to get that, sometimes you've got to get that other sector going,
right,
the private sector, to help move along the public sector. One of the things that you did after your VA experience is sort of interesting is you were compelled to put together a documentary about this. Can you talk about your documentary on veterans with TBI?
Yeah, surely. And I will say, and I actually said this at the Army AMED down there at Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio. I said, my old brain, and your wife could attest to this because she knew me in high school, my old brain would have never been so bold as to say, oh, I think I'll just do a documentary, you know. But because I had a brain injury, that kind of filter is a little bit gone, and I thought, how are we going to get the word out fast enough? And just like this podcast, like you and I were just discussing right before we went on, it, in our world right now, the young people, the millennials, the people who are serving really rely on podcasts and the internet and visual knowledge. So I said, if we could just get, you know, a 20 or 40 minute documentary and let people know what's going on, both with our young soldiers and their families, but also the fact that we need the civilian world and the DOD and the VA to all get together and work together to solve this problem. And that's what we did. So we did some filming out in California, which I fell in love with because every day is a sunny day and you're able to film outside every day. And we talked to about 12 veterans out there, and there's 5 major veterans throughout the documentary. And it's basically them telling their story. What happened to them when they were in combat, in theater? What happened to them when they came back? How they were able to help pick themselves up or how they weren't able to? And one of the things that I found out is just in telling their story, so many of these young veterans actually improved. And, you know, my veterans will be the first to tell you I'm kind of smiling at this because I'm half embarrassed about it, but it's true. They said, you know, Doc, you're the perfect person for this job because you love telling people what to do and we need to take orders. So of these people that we were able to interview for the documentary and talk about what our young veterans and their families need in terms of healthcare and education and employment and how the civilian world needs to get involved, we were actually able to improve every single one of their statures at that time. We had a couple of them who were homeless. We had a couple of these young vets who had actually been what we call couch surfing. You know, they didn't really have a home or an address, but they'd crash for a month in some person's couch and then another month at some other person's couch. And it's been an amazing transformation, a little bit in a veteran, a little bit of rehabilitation, a little bit of assistance from somebody from the civilian world goes a long way. So we have, you know, one of the gentlemen is right now in USC Law School. Another one just graduated from UCLA Business School. A third one became the alternate voice for the San Diego Padres. Now, these are young men who had no place to live when we were talking to them, okay? And that's all in a matter of about 4 or 5 years. So they did an amazing job with that. The 5 major stars that I call them. We took the documentary. We were able to play it on Capitol Hill through the great graces of our representative, our U.S. representative, Steve Stivers, who is a colonel in the Ohio National Guard. And during that particular day, we were able to reach 127 congressional offices, about 27 senatorial offices, and 4 major pieces of legislation were written, 2 have already passed, dealing primarily with traumatic brain injury.
And listeners, you can hear the passion that Dr. Gordon we're talking to has, and I think it's humorous as well that her new brain, her post-TBI brain, lets her be this bold.
Yes, it is.
Is the documentary available on your website?
You know, I don't know if it is, but I will make sure that it is within the next 2 days. And I will send a link to you in case you have someplace on your website.
I'd love to get it out and promote it.
Surely.
So let's turn quickly then to the Resurrecting Lives Foundation that you have founded. You have an incredible board, an incredible advisory board, some great sponsors. Tell us about Resurrecting Lives Foundation.
Okay, so what we kind of came up with the word, the title, Resurrecting Lives, and I did that because of my own brain injury. You know, when we talk about somebody with a brain injury, everybody uses a phrase, you know, bell rung or lights out, nobody home. You know, that's a really common expression. And even though it's kind of slang, it actually does tell the story. There is nobody looking back at you. I mean, we have so many of our young vets who are alive but not really living. So we're bringing them back to life. It may not be the same life they had before they went to war, before their brain injury, but it is their new normal. And what I tell each of them, we want to use your abilities and your attitude and your aptitudes to the best of your own abilities, and we need the civilian world to help you out with that. So what we are doing, we're kind of formulating this right now, and in 2017 we will roll out our employment initiative. And my belief is that we don't want to do, and I'm keeping bold here, okay, keeping bold, and tell the Brigadier General there I'll need some help from her and her buddies, but we really want to change the military separation process. I really do not think that our young men and women should be discharged from the military base and just given a handful of cash and a handful of pills and maybe a disability rating and sent on their way. You know, I believe that we need to get the Fortune 500 companies, we need to get the trade schools, we need to get the educators on the military bases at the end of that TAPS program, at the end of that transitional program, and say, where would you like to go? What would you like to do? Let's see what we can do to help you. And because we deal with the TBI piece, our job is going to be kind of that liaison between the veteran who is leaving service with a known brain injury or one who may discover it later and their HR department or the department in their college or university. Because there is that transition that is very different, and I just learned it from them. I know you and Carol Ann lived it, but you're no longer in the military environment. And where so many of us in the civilian world think how dangerous that is, so many of them think how difficult it is to manipulate through the system here to get your VA benefits, which is something that your law firm has been so helpful at, because it is difficult. And if you have a brain injury and you're trying to work through that, you can't. So we are going to the CEOs, to the chief executive officer. I call it from CO to CEO. They go from a commanding officer to a chief executive officer. We're getting companies to buy in a big way, not just have a hiring fair. And I know that hiring fairs are good, but they provide a job. I do not want to provide a job. I want to provide employment. I want a career. I want a future. I want the entire family to be able to see that, yes, your military service mattered to us. And we really are thanking you by helping you with your transition.
I want to say, listeners, this is an interesting idea that there should be outplacement. When you leave the military, particularly if you have a TBI, shouldn't we have outplacement that gets you right into a new career path?
Correct.
Right over to one of those Fortune 500 companies who are accepting you with all the skills and all the warts that you have, but you're going to work through it, and you're going to work through it a lot better if you've got something in place. It's a great idea, Dr. Gordon. It's bold, and I'm sure your passion will bring you far in implementing it. But tell people a little bit of how they follow you, how they get involved with what you're doing, and if they need, if they have loved ones who have TBIs who may need help, how do they reach out?
Right, that's a very good thing. Yes, our website is our primary way of getting information out and staying in touch with people, and it's a very long website because, after all, the title is resurrectinglives.org, so it's pretty long, and my email address is just drgordon@resurrectinglives.org, and that's G-O-R-D-O-N, like the people who are old enough, Flash Gordon, and I don't know any other very young Gordon, but there's a race car driver. Yes, I know, Jeff Gordon.
Jeff Gordon.
So if you just remember that, drgordon@resurrectinglives.org, if you have somebody who is in need of services, I don't care what state you're in or what country you're in, to be perfectly honest with you, we've taken care of liaison, getting networking for healthcare and employment in 28 states so far, and two other countries, Great Britain and Australia, the coalition forces. So that's a very good way of doing that. I will tell people this, and I do have passion in my voice, and I think it's so important right now for us as a nation to reevaluate where we're headed and really take and embrace our 1% of our country that decided to be brave enough and strong enough and whatever to say, I will serve and I will protect you. And so I think that the entire nation needs to rally behind this cause. We say, you know, resurrect the hero, strengthen the nation. And that's what we're trying to do as well. So if you have congressmen, if you have senators, both within your state and within Capitol Hill, I definitely love Capitol Hill. Like I said, I mean, I'm just an ordinary citizen. It was my five guys with TBIs that were able to get four different pieces of national legislation out there in favor of giving some protection and some cognitive retraining to somebody who had suffered a traumatic brain injury in defense of our nation. It can be done. What we need to do is focus on what we should do as a nation to make us stronger and not be doing so many things to tear each other down. And I believe that the veterans, the military, these are the people who can help us solve that particular kind of divisive issue in the nation right now as well.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Chrissiane Gordon of Dublin, Ohio, for being our guest today, to sharing her experiences both as a TBI patient, but more importantly, maybe as a TBI advocate for our veterans. You can find out what she's doing at resurrectinglives.org and follow her there. Her email is drgordon@resurrectinglives.org. I want to thank everyone for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host.
Thank you so much. You're
welcome, Chrissy. I'm here at Legal Help for Veterans. You can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows at veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.